good. So I thought, because the microphone was over there, that you'd be giving the talk this evening, or this morning. I heard last night it was very good. Was it?
Yeah.
So you want to hear some more? Okay. So anyway, continuing on the instructions and meditation, I'm going to start off with one of my favorite stories and then see if I can go on to, because I was thinking that somebody was going to be talking, asking more questions about things like the deeper teachings, non-self, no will, stuff like that, which is interesting and fascinating, but most people, that it just discombobulates them and they just don't know what to do next. So I'm going to start off with an easy but profound teaching and then just go deeper from that. And some of you may have heard this before, but I don't really care because I like telling it. and that is a very powerful story, which interestingly I heard from a Middle Eastern gentleman when I was at the airport somewhere in the world and just, you know, waiting for the plane to take off and just chatting about all sorts of things. And he told me this story, and I don't know where he got this from. I've never seen it in any Buddhist book, but I thought it was a brilliant story. And it was of the old monks don't lie story. No, many of you, looks like you haven't heard that one before. I'm sure you have over in other talks. But anyway, that was the story which began with the tradition that monks a long time ago used to wander from place to place. And, you know, without any home, just sleeping out in the jungle, in the caves, any place where there could be some nice solitude. And some monks, you know, spend most of their lives doing that. And I had this one opportunity for 3 months, actually more than that, to wander around. And it was a very wonderful experience. In a place like Thailand, you can go anywhere. There's so many villages around, you find some place to eat. They go on arms around, they give you something to eat in the morning. And yeah, it was a nice climate, you could sleep anywhere. So I remember just wandering and just, what I remember was you went to a crossroads, you know, in some roads, and you had no plan. So you can decide when you get there, should I turn left, should I turn right, should I go straight ahead, or should I turn around and go back again? It was absolutely total freedom, with no obligations, no duties, no schedules, no place to go, no people to meet, just total freedom. And I can understand why that was a wonderful tradition in those days. And here, there was this old monk who went wandering over somewhere in, probably in India somewhere, a long time ago. And he came to the dwelling of a poor farmer for his alms food. And the poor farmer was a very devout Buddhist, and so he filled the monk's bowl with food. And then he asked the monk that it is soon to become the start of the rainy season retreat, where the monks are supposed to stop wandering and stay in one place. Have you got a place yet to stay for the rains retreat coming? And the old monk said, actually, no, not yet. So the old farmer went down on his knees, put his hand up and said, Venerable Sir, I invite you to spend the rains retreat with me and my family. Very close to here there is a nice field next to a river, and I can build you a very simple hut there, because monks don't need very much. And you can come to nice solitude, very peaceful, and you can come to my house every morning to get some lunch. All we ask from you is maybe to give us a teaching every week, maybe just, you know, teach some stories to our children, her 2 children, and just give us the chance to make some good karma. So the monk said, okay, because even though it was a very poor farmer, it doesn't cost that much to look after a monk or a nun. And at this point, I like to interrupt the story by saying that there was some consideration when the first Western monks went to Western countries, like to England. And can we afford to look after these people? So, it happened at the time that was, I don't know if you remember Colin Ash. Colin Ash, he was one of the directors of the English Sangha Trust. He was also a professor of economics at Reading University and an advisor to the Bank of England. So he was a top economist. So he decided to do number crunching to find out how much it costs to look after a monastic for 1 year. And when he did all the considerations, you know, food, lodgings, medicines and stuff like that, he made the discovery that it's much cheaper to look after a monk or a nun than it is to look after a dog. And there are many similarities. Like, number one, monks and nuns, we eat out of a bowl. We're always happy what we get. We woof it down very quickly. We live in a well, they call it a cootie for monks and us. It's called a kennel for dogs. But it's very similar, just on a bigger size. And we're very friendly, just take us for a walk and we wag our tail. So he came up with a saying, every home should have one. So forget about dogs and cats, monks and nuns. A little hut in the ground and just put them in there. They're very happy, just feed them and take them for a walk. And they're very nice, and if he wants some nice advice, they go in there, go to the kennel and just... But anyhow, so it was okay. So it's not a big burden to these families to feed this monk. So for 3 months, he would have lovely solitude and a nice simple hut by the lake or the river so he could bathe and wash his robes. And he'd just wander over to the hut and get some food and wander back again. So life was very good. But when it came to the end of the rains retreat, the monk went to the little hut and they fed him with food and he said, the rains retreat is over now. Tomorrow I will be leaving. And at that, even though the farmer knew it was the end of the rains retreat, still over those 3 months he got so attached to the old monk. Not only the farmer, but his wife, you know, started crying. And the 2 children who looked at that old monk like a dear old grandfather, they too started crying. They even had a dog in the house. And as soon as the dog heard that the monk was going to leave, put his tail between his legs and started whining. Even the dog was attached to that old monk. He said, I have to leave. He said, please, please don't. He said, yes, I understand. But my meditation has been very deep. Got some great nimittas and deeper stuff as well. And in my meditation, I've seen that close by, much closer than you expect, there is a hidden treasure. A vast amount of gold and other money. And I want you to have it so you don't have to live in such poverty and work so hard. But, said the old monk, you have to listen carefully and follow my instructions. Otherwise, you won't find that treasure. So even though they were disappointed their monk was going, they didn't mind being rich. So they listened very carefully. And the old monk said, tomorrow morning, just at first light at dawn, I want you to stand at the doorway of your house and wait for the sun to rise. As the sun rises, I want you to pick up that bow and arrow which you use to try and scare away the wild animals. And as the sun, the disc of the sun, rises above the horizon, point the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. When the disc of the sun separates from the horizon, then let the arrow fly, and where it falls, there you will find the great treasure. And If you follow those instructions, you'll find the treasure. Because I'm an old monk, he said, and old monks don't lie. And then he went away. And the following morning, they were up long time before dawn, because, you know, when you're so excited, you're going to be rich. It was a long time. He couldn't wait for that sun to come up. And he stood at the doorway to the house. He picked up the bow and arrow. He pointed it in the direction of the rising sun. And when the disk of the sun separated from the horizon, he shot the arrow, went a long way. And they all ran after it, his wife, the two children, and the dog. Now, in those days, there was no such thing as gender equity. So he gave his wife the spade and told her to dig the hole. Guys, be careful, because it's karma. See what happens next. So they dug the hole, they dug deeper and deeper and deeper where the arrow fell. And what did they find? Nothing. Only trouble. Because that land belonged to a lawyer. And the lawyer happened to be passing by. He said, "What are you doing to my land? That is illegal. You're destroying other people's property. I'm going to sue you. I know you have that farm. I'm going to take it from you. I turn it into a resort or something. But I'm going to sue you for everything you've got." And the wife said, "Not my fault." Him. He told me to do it. And the farmer said, "Not my fault either. The old monk told me to do this." Now that word, old monk, the lawyer stops. Did you say an old monk said you'll find a treasure here? Because the lawyer said, "I'm a Buddhist too, and old monks don't lie." What did he tell you? So when he heard the instructions, you know, that the farmer remembered, he said, "Ah, oh, that's your trouble. You know, look at you. You know, you don't eat well enough. You're too thin. Look," he said, "tomorrow I'll do a deal with you. I'll shoot the arrow. And we'll share the treasure. 51%, 49%. He wrote a contract and made him sign it. Because he was a lawyer. That's what lawyers do. You know when you take a photograph of a lawyer, how you make them smile? You say, "Fees." Not cheese. That cheese doesn't cut it for them. But say, "Fees." Anyway. So he had to sign the contract. So the following morning, the lawyer was there with the farmer, his wife, the two children, and the dog. And as the sun rose, as it separated from above the horizon, the lawyer, you know, pointing the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun, shot that arrow, and it went a long way, much further. And they all ran after it, farmer, his wife, the two children, and the dog, and the lawyer. And where it fell this time, because of karma, the husband had to dig the hole. And he dug and dug, sweating and panting. He dug and dug. And what did he find? Only trouble, yes. Because this time, it dropped into the land belonging to a general in the army. And the general happened to be passing by with his soldiers. He said, "What are you doing to my property? All of you implicated soldiers, cut off their heads." And at that, sort of the farmer said, "You can't do that, I've got a lawyer." And the lawyer said, "Look, it's all this old monk. This old monk said we'll find a treasure here." And at that, he said, "Old monk," said the general. He said, "I'm a Buddhist too, even though I make people cut off their heads. Don't think about that one. That spoils the story a little bit, but never mind. That's only a technicality." "So I'm a Buddhist too. What did he tell you?" And then when the general found out, he said, "Look, it's obvious your mistake. I know old monks don't lie. There's a treasure around here somewhere. But what does a farmer or a lawyer know about archery? You've got to be in the military. I've been training in archery all my life. Look," he said, "tomorrow we'll do a deal. I'll shoot the arrow and we split it three ways." And so, okay, fine. They had no choice. So the following morning, the general was there with the lawyer, with the farmer, his wife, the two children, and the dog. And as the sun rose, the general pointed the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. As the disc separated from the horizon, the general shot the arrow, and it went a huge distance. He was a professional archer. You know, he really knew what he was doing. And they all ran after it. The general, with the lawyer, the farmer, the wife, the two children, and the dog. Dog's important, remember? To the story, remember the dog. And where it landed, they dug a big hole. This time the lawyer had to dig the hole. His turn. Pay off his bad karma by telling other people to do what he should do himself. In the monastery over Bodhidharma, we have this rule, and I think the nuns have taken on this rule as well. Anyone who has a suggestion, if you think it's a good idea, you have to do it. It's a wonderful, wonderful way of stopping suggestions, because people have all these great ideas, but they don't want to do it. So, oh, great idea, you do it. Anyway, so the general got the lawyer to dig the hole. He was digging and digging and digging. And what did they find? Nothing. Only immense trouble. Because this time, the arrow fell and they dug in a hole in the garden belonging to His Majesty the King. And the royal guard arrested them all and put them in front of His Majesty the King. And the King said, "General, I'm surprised at you. You know, you're one of my best generals. You above anybody should know that destroying royal property is a capital offense. I have no choice but to execute you, and the lawyer, and the farmer, and his wife, and even the two children, and even the poor dog would have to be executed, because he was implicated." And the general said, "Your Majesty, you shouldn't execute us, because this is what happened. An old monk said we'll find a great treasure." Are those words? "Did you say old monk?" said His Majesty the King. "Yes, an old monk." And the King said, "I'm a Buddhist too. And old monks don't lie. So this is really interesting. What's going on?" So he said, "I will suspend your sentence for a week until I can find that monk and get to the bottom of this." So the King put them all in prisons. Even the dog had a nice little prison cell next to everybody else for a few days. While he sent his soldiers out to find that old monk, they soon found him. And they brought him back to the palace. When he came back to the palace, the King, in front of all the others, all the other accomplices, sentenced to death, said, "You've got these people into big trouble, venerable monk. Why?" And the old monk said, "Your Majesty, it was because they didn't follow my instructions." "What do you mean?" said His Majesty the King. And just like, you know, how many of you got jhanas, enlightenment yet? "Because you haven't followed my instructions. That's why." "Then what do you mean, haven't followed my instructions?" said His Majesty the King. Said the old monk said, "Your Majesty, I invite you to go to that poor farmer's house tomorrow morning with everybody else. And I want you to listen to those instructions. And I guarantee if you follow them, you will find the treasure. But I would ask you, can you please share it equally four ways? And even your share as a king, even a quarter of that treasure will make you so happy. Imagine how this poor farmer and his family will feel, having that amount of treasure." He said, "Yeah, okay." So the following morning, the King was at the the poor farmer's house, together with the general, the lawyer, the farmer, his wife, the two children, and the dog. Remember the dog. And at dawn, they were there waiting for the sun to rise, and His Majesty, old monk was there too, obviously, His Majesty stood at the doorway of the poor house, and he looked at the monk, and the monk said, "Correct, Your Majesty, you're starting in the correct place." And he waited for the sun to start rising, and he picked up the bow and arrow, And he turned to the old man, "Correct again, Your Majesty." And as the sun started to depart from the horizon, he pointed a bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun. "Correct, Your Majesty." And he was just about to shoot the arrow when the old monk said, "Wrong, Your Majesty." "What do you mean, wrong?" "Don't you remember the instructions," said the old monk, "to point the bow and arrow in the direction of the rising sun? And when the disk of the sun separates from the horizon, let the arrow fly." The king thought for a while. He was holding the arrow between his thumb and forefinger. He let it go, and it flew straight down between his feet. There they dug a small hole and found an immense treasure. "I said it's closer than you expect," said the old monk. And they divided that treasure up, and everybody was happy. Even the dog ate the best dog food out of a golden bowl, had an air-conditioned kennel with room service, lived very happy. "But," said the old monk, "it's not just the money I was referring to. Why is it that when we shoot the arrow of wanting, where it falls, we dig this hole here and this hole there, and what do we find? Nothing, only trouble. We fall in love with somebody else's wife. We get big trouble. We decide to invest in some Ponzi scheme. We get in big trouble. Where the arrow falls, it promises us a treasure, but what do you find? Only nothing but trouble." There's so many other examples. And he said, "No, just let the arrow fall. And where it falls, where you're standing, call the present moment, here and now, exactly where you're sitting and standing right now. There you'll find the great treasure. So stop shooting the arrow of craving. Jhanas, nimittas, enlightenment. Instead, let the arrow of craving, let it go. And it will fall right where you are, in this present moment, right here, right now. And there you'll find all the treasure you can ever need. Let go." And that is absolutely true. You know why? I'm an old monk now. And old monks don't lie. That's a really neat old story about when you want something, shooting over here, shooting over there, you know, you just don't get anything, only trouble. So you let go. The arrow craving falls exactly where you're sitting. Right now you've got enough. Do you believe me? You get lots of trouble, but remember in the end, if you don't get any peace, any happiness, any joy, any jhanas, any enlightenment on this retreat, it's only because you don't follow the instructions, that's all. Anyway, so that's a great example about present moment awareness. Just let it go. But people keep on saying, if I just let things go, it gets nothing, I fall asleep, and just get restless, and just nothing happens, and I waste my time. It's only one more day to go, you know. Only 24 hours, 30 hours. When you go back, what are you going to do? You come all this way, you spend all this money, and they say, "Well, what was it like? What was it like? Did you get anything?" You say, "Well, I learned a lot." "What did you learn?" "Not to go there again." "Well, didn't you hear any teachings? What was the most outstanding teaching?" "Well, there was this joke and that joke." And I'm sure you remember the jokes and stories. So sometimes we think, no, we've got to do something and get somewhere. That's the whole problem. Please let go, for goodness sake. But if I let go, I'll never get anywhere. And that brings me on to one of the other great stories. I wanted to put this in here before the Because the next morning we'll talk about, you know, the last morning, about what to do when you get back, if you do get back. You know what people keep telling me before I get into this story? They keep saying, Ajahn Brahm, how can we meditate? What can we do when we get back to the real world? Now, come on. Is that where you're going to? Is that the real world? Virtual reality? Movies? Where, you know, whatever happens, it's all fantasy world. You know, where you just, people wear makeup, they dye their hair, they just wear boob jobs, I don't know what else other prosthetics people have. You call that the real world? you go into these shopping centres and they got music and sense making you buy more. It's all absolute 100,000% fantasy. Selling you dreams and ideas which don't exist. And then you go into your homes and homes, it's all air conditioned or heated. It's not real. The real world ain't like that. So, this is the real world. Where you're going back to is fantasy land. So it's true, when you think about it, you know, there's a lot to be said that, you know, when you're in the present moment, not into dreams and fantasies, you're coming home, just sitting there with a cup of tea, watching real trees grow, with real mosquitoes biting you, with a real snake slithering through the grass. It's real, isn't it? But anyway, so I'll be talking about that later. But in the meantime, sometimes you say, well, you know, just what have I learned? One of the things about letting go, which is a great story, I told a story about Ajahn Chah and just sitting under the mango trees perfectly still and all this stuff falls. But the other simile which I made up was the simile of the, because I told it to someone on the interviews, I haven't mentioned it here, that's the donkey and the carrot. The donkey and the carrot. If you think that you've got a boss who's stubborn or a partner who's just so stubborn. Donkeys, apparently, are the most stubborn animal in the whole world. And you've got to be very careful of becoming a donkey. In fact, I was a bit concerned when one of the first monks I met in UK was a Zen monk from Japan. And he told us that never write a book. Teach people, fine, but don't put it in books and confuse everybody. Because, he said, anyone who writes a book, the karmic consequence of that is you have to live the next 7 lifetimes as a donkey. I've got many lifetimes as a donkey to get through, because I've written many books. That's what he said. He was the same monk, you know, that was translated what he said. The same monk, he was visiting UK, and I saw him in the first talk he gave when he first arrived. I couldn't speak any English at all. You know, I was desperate for anything, you know, which was, had anything to do with Buddhism. So I went to listen to his talk, and it was just a bit boring. But the next talk, when he came back, he learned some English. And he didn't have much of a vocabulary, but he used it so perfectly. Because someone asked him, you've been, you know, touring around UK for a month, what do you think, what's your impression of Buddhism in England? And he looked at the questioner and he said, books, books, books. Too many, too many, too many. Dustbin, dustbin, dustbin. A few words, but incredibly articulate. That's what he was saying. Too many professors, not enough people actually doing it, you know, practicing it. But anyway, so I've got a few lifetimes as a donkey ahead of me. But anyway, if I am a donkey, I know how to catch carrots. Because a donkey is a stubborn animal. You can get out a stick and beat it, it won't move. So, you use the stick in another way. You tie the stick to the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. The end of the stick, you put a string, and the end of the string, you put a carrot. If you come from Malaysia, you put a piece of durian. If you come from France, maybe a baguette. I don't know. you put that on the end of the, say a carrot, on the end of the stick, and the donkey sees the carrot. He likes carrots. So he moves towards the carrot. And as the donkey moves, the stick moves, as the stick moves, the string and the carrot moves at the same speed. Even if the donkey runs after the carrot, still the carrot's always 2 foot in front of its mouth. So, never catches the carrot. You can see it, understand it, smell it, but you just can't reach it. Just like meditation. Sometimes nimitta, some of you see nimitta, you go there and just keep going away from you. You're almost there, you can smell it through. All these other things in life, you know, perfection, the perfect relationship, whatever it is, happiness, you go towards it and it runs away from you. What goes on there? But the donkeys, they overheard somebody playing one of my tapes. The word gets around, and now the donkeys know how to catch the carrots. So simple, understanding the Dhamma, exactly how to catch the carrots. You know, think, why didn't I think of that before? So, what does the carrot do? What does the donkey do? That donkey runs as hard as it can after the carrot. Doesn't matter, the carrot's still 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. Just like many of you, not all of you, well, maybe a few of you, maybe, was it one of you? Been working very hard. No, you're all very good. Trying to get enlightened or trying to meditate, running after that carrot. So the donkey has been running after the carrot just like you. But then the donkey hears this amazing word. Stop. Let go. Renounce the carrot. So the donkey stops. And what happens when the donkey stops? Sees the carrot swinging away from the donkey. It's not working. Ajahn Brahm's method. It's not Ajahn Brahm's method. Why blame me? Anyway, if it works, you can praise me. But if it doesn't work, please don't blame me. So, the carrot starts swinging away. It can come and let go, relax. You know, if you need to sleep, sleep. Ajahn Brahm, it's 8 days now and I'm still sleeping. It goes further away. You think, oh, I'm just really sleepy, I'm restless, I'm not getting anywhere. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, it doesn't work. Just relax. And the carrot goes so far away. On a retreat, you've never been so restless, sloth and torpor, lazy, getting nowhere. What you think is, the carrot is so, it's 4 foot in front of the carrot's 4 foot in front of the donkey's mouth now. That carrot's never been that far away. But then something happens. Something very unexpected. The carrot going to the peak of its trajectory starts coming towards the donkey. It's never done that before, coming towards the donkey. And what does the donkey do? Efforts driving. No, just stands there. Patient, just waiting, doesn't do anything. That's a trouble sometimes. You tell you to let go. When things start to happen, you start to do something again. So, just sit there. Just watching. And soon that carrot is back in its normal place. 2 foot in front of your mouth. But, now it's coming at top speed towards you. And the donkey just sits there, does nothing. And then, as the carrot comes closer and closer to the donkey's mouth. If you can visualize a donkey, you can understand the importance of this part of becoming enlightened. as the carrot comes closest to the donkey's mouth, the donkey always, it's not just stillness, it's kindness. Don't just sit under the mango tree perfectly still. You've got to put your hand out, open the door of your heart. But for the donkey, he remembers compassion. Carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you. Otherwise it bounces off its teeth. Always visualize, you know, if you ever seen a donkey with these huge teeth, a big mouth, and out again. So that's, you must remember compassion, especially at the very end, otherwise it doesn't work. That's how the donkeys catch carrots. That's how you become enlightened. You've been running very fast. Stop. But it's not working, the carrot's way over there. The carrot's over in India. And then it comes back to you. All you need to do is sit there, wait, another carrot. That is an incredibly effective simile. And you can not only know what to do, which is just stand there and just let it happen, don't interfere, but also it means that, you know, the importance of the kindness, let it happen. And be patient as well. Not patient waiting in the moment, not going forward to try and make it happen sooner because you've only got a day left. No, just wait and it will happen by itself. Letting go. Letting go of the arrow of craving. Falls right where you are. Just here, right now. That's all you need. Whole body, sick, tired, whatever. So simple when you let go. That is why Ananda got enlightened. So, what does it actually mean? Why does this all work? And now we go to the deeper stuff just to really scare you about the will. The deeper stuff is as you get sit there and just, you know, don't do anything, which is suspending your will for a few moments, a few minutes, a few hours, you sit there, you're not doing anything. You're just standing perfectly still, watching the carrot come towards you, because that's what it does. Perfectly still. I never did this. The breath comes to you. I never cultivated this. Just the breath becomes so beautiful, so bright. I never ask for nimittas, they just come. I never developed the nimittas, they just came, got brighter and brighter when I was just sitting here, letting go of the arrow of craving, and it just enveloped me in this beautiful jhanas, otherworldly. I never asked to get insight. After these jhanas disappeared, it was there, obvious, couldn't miss it. What do you see? You see that there's no one there. When I was with Ajahn Chah, now this is one of the great stories from Ajahn Chah, personal experiences. He would come once a week in his last year. He was getting very sick. And we built a sauna for him. And the we found out, I started studying the Vinaya, the monk's rules, and as I said, it gives you an indication of what life was like in the time of the Buddha. And they had saunas. Saunas were not invented by Sweden. They were in India such a long time before. And so we decided it was allowable, one of the things they had in the time of the Buddha, so we decided to build one. Maybe it would be good for Ajahn Chah's health. So we built one. I was, you know, right in the middle of building that one. And he would come once a week. But, you know, these things aren't just compassion. There's a lot of selfishness in there as well. Because we just wanted him to come to our monastery once a week to give a talk. It's an excuse to, you know, to almost like to hijack him. To kidnap him, or monk nap him. Arahat nap him. Whatever it's called. But anyway, that we got him to come to the monastery. And he'd always give a talk. And then have his sauna. And, you know, you can't really predict, you know, if you're going to really give a good talk. You know, sometimes you're on the spot and it's really amazing. Sometimes, so, this particular occasion, Ajahn Chah's talk was just so on the spot. And you get so inspired. You know, it inspires you to understand, make it sound so easy. And just, you know, it is easy when you understand it and follow the instructions. And wow, it was just such an incredible talk. And there's only many other monks looking after Ajahn Chah, you know, in the sauna, just handing him stuff or whatever. So I thought, I'm going to meditate, make use of this inspiration. So I went there behind the hall and sat down. It must have been about a couple of hours. You know, you lose track of time. You don't know how much time it was, but roughly about that time, just blissing out. Oh, just so nice. Inspiration from a good talk is a great way of starting your meditation. When you're really inspired and you see, it's like, wow, that was so amazing. Wow, you've got this free energy. And off you close your eyes and now you're flying in deep meditation. So I know that you know, any time you are really inspired, just go for it. Go and sit down and just make use of that inspiration. It powers you into deep meditation. So I had a great meditation. And as soon as you came out, I just felt so much gratitude for your teacher. He was still having a shower. Maybe there was some little thing I could do for him. So I got up and walked over to the it was a couple of hours, so he'd already finished. And he was actually walking back to his car with a couple of other Thai men, the driver and somebody else who was looking after him. And it was only a small path, and there's no way that I could, you know, just get out, you know, get totally out of the way. We were going to cross. And as he came closer, you know, you could, you know, the monks can read minds. You could how can you explain this? But this is true. I never forget this. He actually was inside of me, in my mind. You could feel him inside. Okay, just what does it feel like? You just know that Ajahn Chah is reading your mind. He's inside, having a look around. For once, I did not mind. Because I was quite happy with my mind, quite proud. Of all the times to come in and have a look around, now's the best time. Other times, please, no. I don't want you to notice what I'm thinking about. So it's a really weird sensation, just to know someone's reading your mind. Because also I was very sensitive. And after, you know, a couple of minutes just looking at me, and then he said, Brahma Wangsa. Really fierce, but not sort of harmful. Just grabbing your attention. He said, Brahma Wangsa, Tamai. Which is the Thai word for why. Why? A very deep question, like a Zen master, why? And then what I answered, I said, I don't know. I was still a stupid monk, nice meditation, peaceful, but I don't know what he was on about. And these great monks, they would never scold you. You know, if anyone would go, you stupid idiot, you know, wasting all my time on someone like you, you get good meditation, you still can't make use of it to get anywhere, you stupid Western man. You think you're smart, going to Cambridge University, hanging out with Stephen Hawkins, and you're just so stupid, get out of here. That's what he should have said. But anyway, instead, he laughed. There's one guy, if he sees sort of, you know, really enlightened people and you do something absolutely stupid, they just think it's so funny. They'll never get angry. So anyway, so then he screwed up his face again and said, Brahma Wangsa, I will tell you the answer. And I was really interested. It was like a personal interaction, you know, with a great master, you know, the student and the teacher, and he's going to give me this amazing transmission of the answer to the question, why? Amazing. And I was just so grateful, you know, so honored that he's going to give this teaching to me, and just waiting, you know, just what the answer was. It must be something really profound, something deep, you know, like, you know, the pure love or original mind or the ground of all being or the ineffable or something which I didn't understand but come from him, okay, I will take it. And he looked at me and I tell him the answer. And the answer was, Mai Mirai, that's Thai. And that means, do you want to know? That means, there's nothing. And he looked at me again, Bama Wang said, do you understand? I said, yeah. And he said, no, you don't. And he walked away. One moment you're up there living with the angels, and next minute you are down to where you belong, in Stupidsville, grade one of the enlightened path, even not even grade one yet. Such a downer. But it was so great, you always remember that. They answer, what? You know, why? There's nothing. Do you understand? No, of course you don't. But it's coming from a great mind, so you never forget things like that. So what does that mean? There's nothing. Go to the heart of the lotus. It's empty. Nothing there. Oh, there's emptiness there. No, there's nothing there. But emptiness is a thing. No, it's not. So, it was as many, many times that people try to make something out of nothing. Literally. When I was talking about that monk, Aniruddha, 17 years before he became a stream winner. This was, you know, the Buddha's cousin. Had huge amounts of good karma. And we know this because many of those monks, in the poetry of the Theragata and Therigata, the bhikkhunis, they told about their enlightenment, how it happened. And he was saying that when he was very young, he had such good karma from the past that he would actually never do without. If he wanted something, it would come, it would appear. And he would never be able to hear the word, there's nothing. If he wanted it, it would come. Because he did great generosity in the past. That was quite weird, but that was the karmic result. So when he was a kid, he was playing a game of marbles with his friends and betting his lunch. And they had these little cakes or pies or something. Let's call it pies, because that's a bit better. So, he had his pies, or pastries. Pastries is nicest. Okay, so he bet his pastries, you know, with his friends. He kept on losing. So being from a rich family, he sent his attendant, said, can you go and ask Mum for some more pastries? So the attendant went and got some more pastries. He bet them and lost them as well. Get some more. So three times, came back. Three times he lost the pastries. Can you get some more? And so the attendant went back. His mum said, there's no more pastries. They're all gone. You've lost them all. It's all gone. There ain't any. So the servant, the attendant, took the basket covered with a cloth to go back to Aniruddha to tell him, natty pastries. Natty means there isn't any. It's gone, finished. Natty pastries. But, according to the legends, there are these heavenly beings who have to make sure the law of karma is always preserved. So if the human beings can't keep that law of karma, they intervene to make sure that this nothing ever goes wrong. So when these devas heard this, they said, well, we can't allow this Aniruddha to have nothing. So they inserted these heavenly pies in pastries into the basket. And the servant didn't know that. So when they actually, this was heavenly food, what the devas, the angels eat. And so when the Aniruddha saw his servant, he said, have you got the pastries? And he said, natty pastries. There ain't any pastries. And Aniruddha looked, and they're the most beautiful pastries he'd ever eaten in his whole life. Even better than Bianca's food. That's saying something. He said, natty pastries? They're the best in the whole world. Why hasn't my mother given me any of these natty pastries anymore? Before. But what natty means was there ain't any. Nothing. So often in life, nothing becomes something. Emptiness. What's it like? It's empty. Describe it to me. Nothing there. What does nothing taste like? Nothing. It's very hard for us to accept. There's nothing. It's gone. Finished. So, what does that mean in the terms of the will? Who's in charge? You ask any psychologist, neuroscientist, and they will tell the evidence is so convincing. There is no one in charge. But what you take to be your will is an illusion. Professor Libet, he does some great works on the will. He had his team of students doing an experiment. They decided at random when they wanted to flex their wrists, open their wrists, flex them. And when they decided to flex the wrist, they pressed a button. And allowing for reaction time, they could actually time when they willed the wrist to open and shut. But they also had these gizmos on the skull to record what was happening in the brain. Because there's something in neuroscience called the readiness potential. A part of your brain lights up just before, you know, you flex the wrist. You can actually see the process happening in your brain. And what he found, again and again, no one could actually find any fault with his procedure and also the results. The readiness potential, the brain lit up first. A few, I think, 0.4 of a second afterwards. This thing which you think is the will arose, and then the action happened. The will does not originate the action. By the time you will, it's already happening. The will does not start actions. It's part of a process which has already begun. By the time you are aware of a decision which you conclude to be autonomous, but it is not. What? Again, that's just basic psychology, neuroscience. But what really impressed me, again, going to those lectures in the Psychic Research Society, when we would hypnotize people, and you're a student, anything for fun. I volunteered to be hypnotized. They couldn't do it to me. Some people are very good subjects, other people aren't. And there's always one person, student, they hypnotize. And they make do stupid things. And this particular guy, they sort of hypnotized him. And it was real to do many stupid things, but they gave the instruction to him. When I touch my right earlobe, said the hypnotist, you will stand up, doesn't matter what's happening, and sing the British National Anthem in a loud voice, beginning to end, no matter what happens. And these are intelligent students. This is interesting. I mean, in a lecture hall full of students, who would actually ever do that? Would you do that right now? Stand up and just sing the, you know, Australian National Anthem? You should have done that yesterday. Does anyone know what the Australian National Anthem is? Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi. That's what we were doing yesterday. So, I was really interested. It took him out of hypnosis, you know, with the suggestion that when I do this, you'll sing the National Anthem, but you won't remember, you know, who told you. We're all waiting. And again, like any sort of person who lectures or gives talks, you always have to be a bit of an entertainer. So this guy, you know, he moved his finger. He's going to touch it now, and then he moved it somewhere else, playing around with us. But then eventually he touched his right earlobe. And this student, in the middle of the lecture, stood up and started singing God Save the Queen from beginning to end in a loud voice. And we were just kidding ourselves, laughing, howling, yelling, and that never stopped him. He went right from the beginning to the end, We thought it was so hilarious that they could make someone do something absolutely ridiculous and stupid. But then, when we calmed down, he asked the guy, "Why did you do that? Student, why did you do that?" And this student gave a reasonable explanation. And it was quite clear to me and everybody else that that student was under the very clear impression that he freely willed to sing the national anthem. To me, it was quite clear he was controlled by the hypnotist to do that. And it was the most stupid thing to do. Yet he did it of what he thought was the most was free will. That sent a shiver up my spine. How much of what I think is free will is actually conditioned, brainwashed? You don't realize it, that's the point. It's already in there, instructions are in there, and you think it's your will? That's scary. We might as well get to understand it and accept it, because that's the way this universe works. And for the last 8 days, I'm very honest with you, I've been brainwashing you. Giving you new instructions. I do that honestly because that's what Ajahn Chah did to me. That's what Ajahn Chah's teacher did to him. If you want to blame anyone, it all goes back to the Buddha. He started this brainwashing. But who brainwashed the Buddha? It's the previous Buddha did. Another story, but there is something called transmission. We actually feed off ourselves out of others. But so what actually happens with the world? Once you realize it's not yours, it makes life much easier. So what actually happens, you let go. Let go of control, just let the Buddha take over. How does that work? So it means that, you know, this is interesting stuff, but, you know, are you really in charge of all this or not? Sometimes you think it's an interesting concept, but is it actually true? So find out for yourself. So what you do, you go in deep meditation. In deep meditation, that's the only place you can find the seat of the will, going deep into the lotus, where the will is, right close to the center. It's actually not in the center, but, you know, 2 or 3 petals out. It's where the will lives. You go in there, and then you find there's no one there. Mami or I, there's nothing. I call that the simile of the driverless bus. I gave that about 25, 30 years ago. And Google stole the idea from me. Seeing those old talks, old books, the driverless bus, and now they, I should patent everything. I could be such rich, all this. No. But anyway, the driverless bus. I said, it's just like you're going on a journey. And, you know, sometimes what life is like, having a wonderful time, enjoying every moment, and it doesn't last that long. This retreat, it's only been a few moments. It's already, you know, close to finishing. Where did it all go? You had a wonderful time. But there are times when you really want to go to the toilet. And say, well, Ajahn Brahm, when are you going to finish this talk? When are you going to finish this talk? And does it last for such a long time? Why is it that in the bus of life, when you're having a good time, the driver always speeds up? When you're having a lot of difficulty and pain, it slows down. This stupid driver called my will, why can't it learn just how to slow down, even park in the happy times of your life, and speed out in top gear when life is getting difficult? Why do these bad times last so long, and the happy times are so short? Because you've got a stupid bus driver, that's all. So what you do, decide, okay, I'm going to teach my bus driver some dhamma. But first, if you're going to teach a bus driver how to drive a bus, you've got to actually go find where the bus driver sits, deep in your mind. And you go there. You go to the front of the bus where the bus driver sits, in this simile, deep inside the jhanas. And you find the bus driver's seat is empty. There's no one there. It's a driverless bus. It's programmed. It's conditioned. So what do? Only got one choice. Go back to your seat, sit down, and shut up. You stop complaining. Yeah, you have a difficult time. No one to complain to. waste of time shouting, "Driver, put your foot down on the accelerator. Get out of here." Having a wonderful time, "Oh, slow down, bus driver, slow down, just enjoy this." It's a waste of time. Bus driver never listens because there's no bus driver there. So what do? You just sit down in your seat and you stop complaining. No craving, no desire, no ill will, which is what I call complaining to the bus driver. That's what desire and ill will are. Come on, come on, you can do this. Another day go, you can meditate, come on, you can do this. Come on, come on, that's complaining to a non-existent bus driver. Stupid woman, you've been meditating all this time, you're getting nowhere, all you've been doing is just sleeping and just hanging out and doing nothing, stupid, stupid, stupid. That's complaining to the bus driver. Who are you complaining to? So you let go. Freedom. Nothing here. So you can relax and be peaceful. So, are you going to do that? Are you going to follow my instructions? I'm an old monk. Ajahn Chah was an old monk. He didn't lie either. So that's what happens. But it sounds interesting, but it goes against the grain. It doesn't matter, you'll do it. And after a while, what happens is you actually get to that bus driver's seat. And that's the freaky thing, because you see it for yourself. Oh my goodness, Ajahn Chah was right. The Buddha's right, there's nothing. There's nothing. What does it mean? What happens is that all the things you took to be yourself vanish. The last little story, simile, of the, what's it called? The frog and the tadpole. There once there was a little tadpole, and the little tadpole lived in a nice lake on a retreat center. Down there. And the little tadpole, she was really smart. I don't know if you've seen it, it's got a little tadpole school down there. They teach all the little tadpoles that, she actually really excelled in chemistry. So she did so well in her year 12s, that's the equivalent of A-levels in Australia, that she went to Taupo University, where she actually majored in chemistry. She was, again, so smart, she got a PhD, and her speciality was water. And even every now and again, because there was a few monks came over and discussed the Abhidhamma by the lake, they also learned Abhidhamma, and you know everything about Abhidhamma, about water. But do you think that little tadpole, she could understand what water was? She knew all the theory, but how can a tadpole know the nature of water no more than a fish can know the nature of water? You've lived it all your life. How can you know what it is? But the difference between a tadpole and a fish is that one day the tadpole, she grows legs and arms. Her body changes. And she doesn't really know what's going on. But one day, little tadpole becomes a frog. And the Mrs. Frog, she jumps out of the lake. That is the weirdest thing ever. Nothing like ever anything it's experienced before. Because when it's sitting on the edge of the lake or the pond, something's missing. Something which has always been there is absent. And what's that? Water. Only when water disappears can the tadpole, now a frog, understand the nature of water. When it's always there, you take it for granted. You'll never really know it. That is a simile of what happens when you go into these deep meditations. You grow nimittas, and you jump outside of the lake, five senses, into a place like you've never been before, Jhana land. And there, things are missing. Things which have always been there are gone. In particular, your will. That's why you're so still. You can't move. There's no buttons to press. No one can choose anything. You're still. Now you understand what this will is. Only when it vanishes. Before then, it's a theory. Before then, you can maybe do some science on it. It makes a lot of sense. It's reasonable. But even then, people still, oh yeah, but it's science. But in real world, I make choices. Do you? Once you get into jhanas, you will realize there's no one there. Joy at last. To know there is nothing. Sad, 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 ooh, hee hee hee. Now you're going to probably think a lot, and there'll be so many questions tonight, but I don't know, if there's nothing, if there's no will, then why do the little world? Okay, but I'm prepared for that. Okay, interview time, those who want interviews. Okay.